From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. If you don't have your health, you have nothing. If you or a loved one have ever had to endure the cruel truth of that maxim, you know what I mean. Most joy just falls away. Nothing matters more than regaining your health. You can go from a life full of possibility to a life of limits. You no longer feel free because you are not. The illness, its physical and financial toll, rule everything. So if sickness can equate to losing your liberty, why then, in a nation that proclaims to prize liberty above all, why does that nation not see healthcare as a universal human right? Well, Timothy Snyder, I'm going to put you on the spot. Can you make sense of that paradox?
I think I can. I think most of the time we forget about our bodies. When we talk about rights, we don't think about our bodies. When Jefferson spoke of the pursuit of happiness, he meant the physical pursuit of happiness. But until the very last moment, until we're so sick that we think we might die, that position I was in last December, then it all comes clear that if you can't speak, you don't have freedom of speech. If you can't move, you don't have freedom of assembly. But all that time when we're not thinking about our bodies and freedom, other people are thinking about our bodies as objects. Our problem in America is that we think the market is there to give us freedom. The market is there to give us objects. But if we're not careful, our body becomes one of those objects, which is what it is in our present system of commercial medicine. So that's why it is that we have to think of health or healthcare as a human right, so that we're not treated as objects, so we can be free.
Right. Well, of course, Black Americans for centuries have had to deal with the consequences of bodies being commodified. So this is a new context that we're talking about it in terms of healthcare. And I want people to know that Tim Snyder is a professor of history at Yale. He's a permanent fellow at the Institute for Human Sciences in Vienna, Austria. He's a scholar of 20th century authoritarianism and tyranny and author of many books. Now, his latest book is called Our Malady: Lessons in Liberty from a Hospital Diary. So tell us, Tim, what happened? It was December of last year, right? When did you first get an inkling that something wasn't quite right with your health?
Well, I was on an airplane, and my abdomen hurt a little bit, and I ignored it. And I saw some doctors in Germany, got myself to go to the hospital, and they unfortunately overlooked what turned out to be appendicitis. My appendix burst, but being one of these Americans who was taught to ignore pain, I ignored that and flew back to the U.S., where my appendicitis was eventually diagnosed and where my appendix was removed. But then the trouble really started, because in that surgery, the doctors had noticed but then forgot about and neglected to treat a second infection of my liver, which was a consequence of the first infection in my appendix. So I was kicked out of an American hospital after really just a few hours after that surgery with another infection, which wasn't mentioned to me. And so then I was in and out of a couple of more hospitals. Finally, it landed in the American emergency room right at the end of last year, where I sat for 17 hours until someone finally figured out that what had happened was that people in the same hospital had made a mistake. What had happened was that the liver infection had spilled into my blood. I was in sepsis, which is something that people really shouldn't be dying of in the 21st century. And that's the place where I was when I got close to death.
So, and you were in the ER in the hospital, you said, for 17 hours. Was that before you were admitted?
No, I was. So, I mean, the admission took a crazy long time too.
Okay.
And I mean, all these things which seem like details of one story are actually structural features of a larger system. It's too hard for us to get in to get the treatment we need. And then it's too easy for us to be expelled before we're really ready to leave the medical system. So I was on the verge of death on December 29th. My family decided, my wife decided to get me back to the city I'm from, New Haven, Connecticut, for treatment. We were unable to get me into the emergency room. I think in part, you know, I was very privileged in the sense that I had a friend who was a physician who met me at the emergency room, but it was Saturday night around midnight. And my friend, although she is, you know, she's a very, very talented and well-known physician, is also a Black woman. And I couldn't talk. So on a Saturday night, I think it might have counted more that she was a Black woman than that she was a physician. We had the hardest time getting into the emergency room. And then once I was in the emergency room, we had the hardest time also getting the diagnosis. So it was 17 hours before I was treated from the time that I was admitted. Nice. I was in sepsis for 9 hours in an emergency room before I was given antibiotics.
Okay, so just to be clear, I mean, I think this the story about your physician friend who tried to help you get into the ER, I think is important. So what you're saying, or in fact what she told you, she worked at that very hospital, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, but not in the emergency department. And so by virtue of her being a Black woman, was I'm going to presume that she wasn't wearing her hospital garb, right? Because she was wearing her winter coat on December 29th. But did the admitting staff just not take her seriously about like she was trying to advocate for you to get admitted?
You know, it's funny how when you're really sick, when you're facing death, the things that are your fundamental knowledge about your country or about your society come to the surface. Maybe the things that you don't think about every day. But when I was in the lobby of that emergency room, and then when I was in the emergency room, I kept obsessing about the thing that you just said. So my friend was wearing her credentials around her neck, but it was freezing cold, and so she had her fleece zipped up, which meant that her credentials weren't always visible. And as I was lying there, basically immobilized and helpless and unable to think, what remained of my consciousness still knew that this was very important, right? Like this base knowledge about how America actually works is what came to the surface. So yes, in the lobby, I know that the nurses didn't take her seriously, not just because they didn't admit me right away, but also because later, when I was behind a curtain in the emergency room, I saw those two nurses walk by and heard them talking about my friend, not knowing that my friend and I were behind the curtain as they walked by. Then when we were in the emergency room, there were a series of exchanges between my friend and other doctors, which I am sure would have gone a different way if she had been 30 years older and of another gender and had white hair. That to me at the time was just as clear as day. I didn't want to say anything about it at the time. There was enough pain in that room as it was. But I mean, this was pretty unmistakably clear.
Mm. There's a lot I want to get into with you, Tim, about the U.S. healthcare system, and we will dedicate the whole hour to this. But there's one thing I just can't let go of that's at the beginning of your story. I mean, you said that doctors in Germany missed your appendicitis. I mean, you could make the argument that none of this would have happened if they had picked up evidence of a somewhat a terrible but somewhat common ailment.
Yeah, it was important for me to put that part of it in there, because in a lot of the book, I'm talking about how things are better in Europe, and they are. You know, people in countries like Germany live longer than in the U.S. I've been treated a bunch of times, and my family's been treated a bunch of times on both continents. One of my children was born in Europe, the other was born in the U.S. I've got a pretty solid basis for comparison, but I didn't want to suggest that everything in Europe is perfect. The Germans do have a certain tendency to think that you shouldn't use antibiotics, and as a result, they, I think, also have a certain tendency to diagnose things that are bacterial as viral instead, which was the mistake they made. They didn't use a CAT scan when they should have. They ended up thinking that I just had some kind of viral infection of my abdomen, and they sent me out. So you're right. That's part of the problem. I mean, I should take some of the responsibility for this too, though, because I don't think I did a very good job. I mean, I speak good German. That's not the issue. But I don't think I did a very good job of telling them just how much I actually hurt. And I think without that, it was a little bit harder for them to see the appendicitis. And of course, that was like the beginning of a long parade of mistakes that were made.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that parade continued in the United States in multiple hospital visits. So I have to say, you almost died. That's what you're describing. And for very keen listeners to On Point, they will recognize you, Professor Snyder, because we talked to you in July in one of our best received shows that we've done all year when we talked to you about authoritarianism and Portland, Oregon. And I have to say, at that time, Tim, I had no idea that this had happened to you just a half a year earlier. So my apologies for not asking about your health then. But I'm so glad you could come back and join us to talk about what you chronicle in terms of what you endured at the end of last year. Ultimately, how long were you in the hospital? How long did it take you to regain your health?
Well, the first night I spent in the hospital was the 3rd of December in Munich, Germany. I was released from the hospital finally in the U.S. on January 16th. There were two more brief hospital stays after that. I was injecting myself with antibiotics through a PICC line into April, and my treatment finally ceased at the end of June. So since June, I'm no longer being treated, which means that a lot of this unfolded under the shadow of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. Some of those later hospital visits were taking place, you know, as our medical system was being turned towards Corona and COVID.
Well, we are talking this hour with Tim Snyder. He's a professor of history at Yale. He's a historian of 20th century tyranny and authoritarianism. His new book, though, focuses on the U.S. healthcare system. And he posits that a denial of healthcare as a human right is a limit to liberty in the U.S. The book is Our Malady, Lessons in Liberty from a Hospital Diary. We'll have more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour with Timothy Snyder. He's a professor of history at Yale University, a scholar of 20th century authoritarianism, of tyranny. His new book, however, focuses on the question of liberty in the United States and how the healthcare system in the United States maybe a massive limit on what freedom is in this country. His book is Our Malady, Lessons in Liberty from a Hospital Diary. So, Tim, can you tell us a little bit about you talk about how in the two pure emotions really sustained you through all of this. And one of them was an almost blinding rage. Can you tell me more about that?
So I put this book together, trying to put myself back together, and then as I was writing it, I thought some of these things that I'm thinking about maybe can help us put ourselves back together as a people in the middle of this pandemic and this general disaster. I couldn't have done any of it without the rage. I mean, it's my deep conviction that I wouldn't have survived without the rage. The rage was the dominant emotion on the 30th and the 31st of December, the 2 days after my first surgery. I couldn't really move my body, but I had these fantasies that I was moving my body. And the rage was about, it wasn't against anyone or anything. It was about not existing. It was about imagining what it would be like not to exist. And of course, this has to do with freedom because I was imagining the futures of my daughter and of my son without me. And in a future without me, I, of course, would not be free to affect how their lives would go. And that rage kept me going. And it has to do with freedom. I mean, part of what makes us free, although I would emphasize only part, is that sense that I should be here. I should be alive. I should be able to connect with other people. I should be able to assert my uniqueness. I should be able to do the unpredictable things that make me myself. That came through very powerfully, you know, in my mind, when the mind was really the only part of me which was still working.
So this gets us right to the traditional American conception of liberty. I mean, the I shoulds that you're talking about are the freedoms to, right? The freedoms to do what you want, the agency to live the life that you wish to live, to walk about on the streets, buy what you want, be who you want to be. This, the freedoms to, that's very, very American. But one of the things that to me shines clear in your book is that we don't pay enough attention to the importance of the freedoms from, right? Freedoms to be free from poverty, to be free from fear. Is that one of the things that really makes it difficult for the United States to imagine more holistically a healthcare system that functions better?
Yes, yes. I mean, thank you for that. I mean, these were thoughts which came very clearly to me while I was in that hospital bed. You know, I had the rage sometimes, and then sometimes I had a very different feeling, which was a feeling of empathy, that there was no point in being alive except insofar as you were alive inside other people's lives, and that if I were to die, it wouldn't just be that I was ending and all these unpredictable futures would end. It would be that the me that's inside my family or my friends would also die. And that was a very different, a much gentler feeling. I think in politics, or in the politics of freedom, the two parts that correspond to these emotions are solitude and solidarity. We have to be able to be by ourselves. That's important. We have to be able to make our own decisions, have our own thoughts, lead ourselves in ways that are particular to us. But at the same time, without the solidarity of others, we can never become that kind of individual. If there isn't a terrific amount of emotional and financial resources put at the very beginning of life, children don't grow up to be the kind of people who can very easily think in terms of all of the choices that are available to them. If we don't have, for example, healthcare that we can rely upon, then we're going to spend our time, as I think you're suggesting, full of anxiety and fear. And when we're anxious and when we're fearful, we don't see possibilities. We might feel like we're free, but so long as we're trapped in those emotions, we see a very limited set of things that we can do.
We have to talk more about this for a second, Tim. I'm sorry to interrupt here, but this is the reality of day-to-day life for many millions of Americans, right? I mean, the fear of being one paycheck away from losing the roof over your head or the food on your table or being able to pay for the things that your kids need in school, being one paycheck away from that. And that paycheck could be instantly, like in a snap, be taken away because of that one hospital trip, that one unexpected ER admission. I mean, this is where healthcare, the brittleness of our healthcare system, really is embedded deeply in these very fears that we're talking about. It's one of the primary causes of those fears.
Of course, the striking thing is that it doesn't have to be that way. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've spent so much time making ourselves into the country which has this kind of healthcare. We've spent so much time developing this very specific system of American commercial medicine, where our bodies are ultimately objects, and at the end of the day, what really matters is profit. But there's nothing natural about that. We've made that happen. It's also possible to consider healthcare as a right. It's also possible, and really actually not that hard, to have systems in which people take for granted, you know, whether they're rich or whether they're poor, they take for granted that they'll be able to go to the hospital if they're sick. There are countries in the world where people who are also living from paycheck to paycheck also are unemployed, but are not worried about healthcare because they know that if they're sick, they have insurance and they will be treated and they will be treated decently. And that's not just a matter of their lives. You know, as you say, it's also a matter of their freedom because it means that they're free of that basic existential fear and anxiety for themselves and for their children. We all are afraid for our health. That's normal. The question is whether that fear is addressed and resolved as it can be, or whether it's manipulated, which it is in our country.
Well, throughout this conversation, I'd love to continue to weave the details from your experience in the hospital. So after that first day, those first 17 hours, what is it that you were observing about your treatment? That you were writing down in these notebooks about how and how that related to this sense of like, what does it all mean about who I am and my agency in this world?
One of the very first things that happened after I was conscious enough to have conversations is that I realized that a number of my colleagues thought that I had behaved very strangely in the emergency room because I hadn't called in any important people to help me. And that really got me thinking. I mean, we've talked a little bit about race, which is one of the inequalities that bedevils our health system. I hope we'll talk more about it.
Yes.
But another inequality is that of wealth. I mean, the idea is that, you know, everybody, as it were, knows that our hospitals are broken. And so if you're privileged up to a certain point, you should know that you need to pick up the phone and call somebody who's even more privileged than you. And I mean, this got me thinking about a lot of things, about a delusion that I think most of us live under. I think people who have decent insurance in the US think we're doing okay. But we're actually not. I mean, of course, there are people who are worse off than we are, and that's essentially a problem for the people who are worse off. But it's also part of a system in which we think we're relatively better. You know, it creates this sense of privilege, and sadly, it creates a sense of sadism because the people who have the better insurance cards think I'm going to be okay, precisely because somebody else is not going to be okay. And we all get caught into this system. We get caught in this system of privilege, and the result is that it's not just inequality inside the system. It's that even people who have relatively good care, as I do, have much worse care than other people in other countries do. Anyway, one of the first things that happened, which I wrote down, was that people thought that I was crazy because I didn't call some patron to get help.
So, about this self-delusion. I mean, you're saying that there's a self-delusion even amongst people who are well insured in this country. I mean, what evidence would you use to pierce that delusion?
I think to pierce that delusion, you have to look at other countries. You know, I mean, there's a reason why Canada basically doesn't exist in the American public sphere, and that's because the Canadians are one of the countries where healthcare basically works, and we can't have that. We can't see that. I mean, I think the easiest way, you know, for those people who are relatively privileged to see this is to catch themselves thinking about it, because we all do. I mean, to use an example from a completely different part of life, when I was in Vienna when my first child was going to be born, I went to birthing class with some other couples. And the other guys there, the part of the birthing class was that like the men split up and we talked, which was kind of cool. But the other guys were talking about what they were going to do with 2 years of parental leave, how 2 years of parental leave was going to be split up between their partners and them. And I was trying to convince them that the 3 months that my wife had for parental leave was good. And I realized, of course, it was laughable. Like, these guys weren't necessarily privileged. One of them was unemployed. But they were all going to have really decent parental leave. And I was trying to tell them that 3 months was good, and they were laughing at me. And I realized the only reason I thought 3 months was good was because it was relatively good in America. And that's the trap we're all in. The trap that the relatively privileged people in America are in is they think, okay, I've got something which is relatively better than other people. And then we feel good because of that. And then we don't look around and see that in other normal, democratic, prosperous countries, everybody is doing better than we are, not just the privileged. Everybody is doing better than we are. But so we don't see what we need to see. And also we get trapped in this cycle where, you know, we don't feel like we're one country because our whole sense of doing better is based upon other people doing worse.
So American exceptionalism is producing this myopia, I'd say, the belief in American exceptionalism. You see that pattern outside of the tunnel vision that we have in healthcare. I mean, I want to lean on your scholarship as a historian. Does not a nation's belief in its own exceptionalism, it can lead it down dark paths? We've seen that in history.
Yeah. I mean, I would, before I answer that, I just want to say, like, I think, you know, I wrote this book because I care about my country, you know, and in that sense, like I'm taking part in American exceptionalism, but my American exceptionalism is one of loyalty and love. You know, I care about my country and therefore I want it to do better than it's doing, especially in vital areas like health. And then if exceptionalism means that you think your country is better than everyone else, I mean, that's the most cliched, banal, normal thing. I mean, people around the world who don't think about it also have the same kind of exceptionalism. If you're exceptionalist in that way, all you're really doing is blinding yourself to the possibility of learning from other countries, and you're also blinding yourself to your very real problems. I mean, at the beginning of the pandemic, I knew some Americans who were living in Europe, and they had this immediate idea they should return to America. And I thought, are you crazy? Like, a pandemic is the worst time to come back to the United States. You should stay right where you are. And I was right, you know, but they had this sort of instinctive feeling that somehow it was going to be better in America. And of course, you know, of course, as it played out, it was actually a disaster. Or at the beginning of the epidemic, people went on TV and said, well, of course, we have the best medical system in the world. And Americans say that kind of thing, and nobody questions them. You get away with saying things like that. We don't. I mean, we have wonderful nurses and doctors. We have really, really talented and devoted people who risk their lives. But we do not have the best medical system in the world, not even close. And until we face that basic fact, we can't ask the basic questions about what we need to do to get better.
Yeah, I completely agree with you on this, Tim, because obviously, I'm sitting here having this conversation with you in Boston, Massachusetts, where you throw a stone and you hit a high-class, world-class healthcare institution. Okay, so I think really when people say, when that cliche is trotted out about how we have the best healthcare system in the world, what they're talking about, and most particularly when political leaders trot that out, is they're talking about, you know, they're talking about Massachusetts General Hospital, they're talking about Mayo Clinic, et cetera, where if you have enough insurance or enough money, you can get the best healthcare in the world. But that is for, I mean, that's the inequality piece that you're talking about. I mean, if you're not an emir who's using the concierge service at these hospitals and you're a normal American, that is not going to be the kind of treatment you get. You might even be living in a part of the country that's a healthcare desert and doesn't even, it's rural hospital closed down in consolidation as businesses buy them up and close rural hospitals down. But why is it that truth, that ground truth that Americans have been living with for so long, I would say until recently, that has not been enough of the national conversation until relatively recently. Why?
I still don't think it's enough for the national conversation. I'm really hopeful that this pandemic will be a chance for us to think some of these things through. I mean, if we look at the basic numbers, things like how long we live, American longevity peaked in 2014. You know, I teach students who were born around 2000, 2001, 2002. So, you know, American lifespan peaked when they were young teenagers, and it's been stagnating ever since. I mean, what kind of a vision of future is that for anybody? And, you know, the inequality manifests itself, the staggering inequality manifests itself in even more radical things. We have we have an oligarchical conversation about immortality, you know, about people living forever, at the same time when most Americans are actually living shorter lives, right? And that's a sign of the larger problem. I mean, there's the kind of inequality we talked about before. There's also the inequality where a lot of the people who really matter have just think rightly or wrongly, they think they've just bought themselves completely out of the system. And so, I mean, this is why we have to think of healthcare as a right, not just from the point of view of the patient, but also from the point of view of doctors. If we don't think of healthcare as a right, it's hard to think our way forward to the kinds of reforms like banning gag rules on doctors, or like forgiving medical school debt for doctors who work in underserved areas. We won't be able to think our way through to that unless we start from the premise that we all have the right to care. Because of course it's true what you say. It's not just that, you know, poor people have a hard time in cities, it's that there are big swaths of this country where it's actually very hard just to see a doctor.
Yeah. Well, there's more when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour with Tim Snyder. He is a professor of history at Yale. He focuses, or his scholarship has long been focused, on 20th century authoritarianism and tyranny. He's author of many books, including On Tyranny and The Road to Unfreedom. His latest book, though, takes a look at what freedom and liberty mean in America in the absence of universal health care. And it's based on his own really dreadful experiences in American hospitals at the end of last year. His book is called Our Malady: Lessons in Liberty from a Hospital Diary. And we have an excerpt of the book, by the way, at onpointradio.org. So, Tim, we were talking about how inequality is one of the things that you point to as drivers for our dysfunctional healthcare system. But I want to go back to one that's also equally important, and you write about this, that you want to talk about more, and that is race. So tell me, what did you learn, what did you experience that made you want to focus on race or racial injustice as one of the reasons why there isn't universal healthcare in this country?
Well, that's a tricky one for me, because I mean, all I can say is that I experienced something for a few hours, which African Americans experience their whole lives. I mean, there was a moment where my life chances decreased because of a racially defined situation, and you know, in that moment, I found myself in an emergency room where also, you know, aside from me, it was a Saturday night. So there were lots of African Americans in that emergency room suffering from various things that in a better country they wouldn't have been suffering from, or in a better health system would have been treated somewhere besides an emergency room. And it got me thinking about a couple of things. It got me thinking about how, from birth to death, African American women and men are facing things that other people don't face. And African-American women and men who become doctors are also facing things that other people don't face. It got me thinking also about an institutional problem, which goes back to your very first question, why don't we think about healthcare as a right? Because honestly, it's obvious that healthcare should be a right. The idea of the pursuit of happiness means nothing without healthcare. I mean, even Jefferson, the author of that phrase, said that you can't pursue happiness without health. But part of the reason we don't see it that way is a certain kind of racism, where white politicians say to white constituents, well, we can't have the welfare state. We can't have something like universal healthcare because all those blacks and all those immigrants will just take advantage of it. And strong, hardworking people like ourselves will be exploited. And there's a kind of double punch to that. The first part is you're confirming racism against others. You're saying those people are whiners, they don't work, they'll just take advantage. But you're also flattering the white people. You're saying, you people are so tough, you're such individualists, you don't actually need help from the state. And that's fatal for the white people as well. So yeah. Our racism allows this argument, which has functioned very well since Ronald Reagan. And that argument has the effect that we don't have a proper welfare state. We don't have universal health care. And the way that we're physically sick then also interacts with the way that we're morally sick. The two of them work together. You know, our moral sickness is part of our malady. It's part of the malady that I'm talking about.
Well, you know, back in June, we spoke with Eduardo Porter. Now, he's an economics reporter for The New York Times and an author of a terrific book. It's called American Poison, How Racial Hostility Destroyed Our Promise. And I mean, Tim, Eduardo has written an entire book about exactly what you like, literally exactly what you're talking about. He looks across American history and finds that every time there has been a push for the expansion of certain sets of rights or programs even that would actually benefit everybody, because they were initially designed to benefit everyone, regardless of race in this country, those initial expansions received a lot of pushback in American history. And so I just wanted to play a little bit of what Eduardo Porter told us in June. First of all, he talked about how in the United States, this country routinely falls below other industrialized nations when it comes to health data and health outcomes.
One of the reasons that we're at the bottom of that pile is that we did not enact policies that would allow us, you know, to lift basically the floor on Americans, kind of like on the bottom rungs of opportunity and well-being. And that was a political decision. And so that's kind of like what justifies my statement mm-hmm. that we just let this vast inequity happen without really caring enough about what was going on with the vast millions of Americans of limited means and scant opportunity.
And Eduardo Porter had a specific example for us. He visited Harlan County, Kentucky, a couple of years ago. And at the time, then Governor Matt Bevin held a town hall. And in Eduardo's words, Governor Bevin started railing against Medicaid, a program that benefited the majority of Harlan County's own residents. But somehow those very residents didn't take offense.
And even though there's very few people of color for these folks to actually have any real knowledge of how, you know, people of color are, it's more an abstract thinking that there's this other person that's not me, that's not like me, that is abusing this. And hence I should attack the program. And I actually did. I talked to some folks there, and a lot of the argument against the safety net ended up moving towards immigrants. Mm-hmm. The idea, oh, well, we can't help immigrants. Immigrants come from afar. They should not have access to our programs. We can't help ourselves. Why should we be helping immigrants?
That's Eduardo Porter, author of American Poison, How Racial Hostility Destroyed Our Promise, from a conversation we had in June. So, Tim Snyder, I wanted to play those cuts because they do buttress what you were saying about race being a driver in the prevention of the American mind, the nation's mindset about expanding rights. Okay, so what would it take? What would it take to for this country to have a sense that, well, and actually for all of us to be free, we have to be secure of our bodies, secure of our health. How would we shift the mindset to arrive at that kind of new fundamental framework?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. I mean, there's a level of life here, and there's the level of liberty. You know, when we decide we're not going to have the kinds of programs that you and Eduardo Porter are talking about, it ends up affecting Black people, but it also ends up affecting everyone. So if you're an African-American woman and you're pregnant, there are 70 countries you could go to, 70, where you'd be less likely to die in childbirth in the United States. But if you're a white woman, you're relatively better, but there are still 40 countries or more that you could go to and you'd be less likely to die of childbirth than in the United States. And you know, I just find that so painful. And it's an example of this larger problem of what I call in the book the economy of pain. You know, we get persuaded, white people get persuaded that they should suffer just so that other people should suffer more. And that unfortunately works, that kind of argument. And I think the way to work against it is first of all to talk, you know, the way we've been talking, that this is not about a privilege that white people should be ashamed of. It's about a right that everybody should have. It's not about a privilege that we do or don't deny to African Americans or to immigrants. It's about a right that everyone should have. And that language of rights, I think, can help people to see this as a matter of basic freedom, i.e. something which is not up for discussion. The second thing that we can do is talk about history, because it's true. I mean, what happened in the pandemic in 2020, where Blacks and Hispanics were affected more than everyone else, Native Americans too, that's just a replay of American history on a specific example. One of the important things about Black Lives Matter is getting us to talk honestly about history, because when we talk honestly about history, then we have a chance of getting out of some of these syndromes. And I guess I'm also hopeful that the pandemic itself will begin a conversation where we can start talking from first principles and not just about making minor repairs.
Has the pandemic revealed that our commonly accepted definition of liberty is the wrong one?
Yes, it absolutely has. I mean, if you're dead, you're not free. You know, there are more than 200,000 of us now who are dead, and 150,000 or so of those people simply should not have died, and they didn't die for anything. There is no point to their dying, and they are not free. That their family members and their friends who had to see them die, they have lost some of their freedom because they've lost the future that they thought that they were going to have. We're in a medical system where we can't make preparations for a pandemic because everything is defined commercially. We're in a mental system where we don't think about our bodies as part of our freedom. And in that way, we're deluded. And that way, we've fallen into a trap. We can't be free without our bodies, which means that the language of freedom has to include, I think even has to begin with, the idea that health is a human right. If we don't learn that, this sort of thing is just going to happen again. And each time it will seem accidental. It will seem like, you know, just a mistake here, just a deception here, just some bad luck there. But until we can break out of this mental system, until we can actually dignify, you know, the notion of freedom by adding to it the notion of health. We're not diluting freedom when we do that. We're making freedom possible. We can't be free without health, just like we can't really be healthy without freedom. Those two values go together and complement each other. We need them both.
So how would you define, given all that we've talked about, Tim, how would you define what liberty is or should be in America?
So it includes more than one thing. That's the key part. If you think that freedom is just about yourself, then you end up falling away from the facts of the world, because the facts of the world are always about other people, not just you. If you think freedom is just about yourself, you end up moving away from your reason and towards your emotions. And if you think that freedom is just about yourself, then you're incapable of taking part in the conversation about the larger institutions, whether they're public schools or public health, which we all need as young people and throughout our lives in order to become free. So I think liberty has to be a balance between solitude and solidarity. We have to be the special, unique people that we are and strive to be. But at the same time, we have to understand that everyone, if freedom is the most important thing, then everyone has a right to it. And if everyone has a right to it, that means we should, our very first priority as a people should be to think about the institutions that will make us all the most free, that we can't do it without institutions. It's ludicrous to think that, for example, a newborn baby is going to be free without institutions and without support. But we all begin as newborn babies. So if we want to maximize freedom in this country, which so many of us think would be a good idea, we have to think about the institutions, the health institutions and the other ones that would help us all from the moment we're born to the moment we die to be as free as we can. So solitude, but also solidarity. I think liberty has to have both of those ideas.
I think what you're saying is so incredibly important. And I want to actually just thank you for earlier when you said that you bring this critique out of a sense of love and loyalty for this country. I come from it from the same perspective, Tim. And that's why I over the past many months have been just wrestling with this fundamental truth that you're talking about, that the sort of mythological conception of what liberty means in America or American liberty has centered on the idea of the individual, that it, in opposition to institutions. But modern life, I mean, so that was an idea born of the 18th century. But modern life is so complex. Healthcare, our system of healthcare is the perfect example of that, or an ideal system would be the perfect example of that, that it cannot confer the liberties that we all deserve without those big institutions. And I think that that's still something that, as you said, we are struggling with as a nation. So do you feel optimistic, though, that this country can change those core values just enough to meet the what's required in this modern moment?
I certainly think that it can be done. And I think it can be done because other places have done it. I think it can be done because a lot of us are trying to learn lessons from the year 2020. And I think it can be done because we don't have to break with the idea of freedom to have universal health care. We just have to be free enough to challenge our own myths. I mean, one sign of being a free person is that you're free enough to challenge your own country's myth about freedom. And that's what we have to do. If you want to have a bigger idea of freedom, you have to break the one that you already have, the one you're walking around with in your head. And the truth about freedom is that there's a paradox here. We want to be free as individuals. I agree with that. But to be free as individuals, here's the paradox: you need help. No one is free without help. And the help has to be complex and institutional. So if we care about freedom, then our first move has to be, what can we do to help as many people as we can in this country to be as free as they can for as long as they can?
Well, Timothy Snyder is the Richard C. Levin Professor of History at Yale University. He's a fellow at the Institute for Human Sciences in Vienna, author of many books, including On Tyranny, The Road to Unfreedom. His latest is Our Malady, Lessons in Liberty from a Hospital Diary. We have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. Tim Snyder, it is always a great pleasure to have you on this program. Thank you so very much.
Meghna, thank you. I was very glad we could do it.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.